Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, our first podcast of the month of December. Hey, by the way, gentlemen, welcome to Impeachment Month. It's going to be all impeachment all the time, right?
Happy Impeachment Month.
I'm Charlie Sykes.
Impeachment Advent?
Yeah, we are. You know, there should be an Impeachment Advent calendar.
Oh, missed merch opportunity.
Yeah, we are here in the DC Bulwark studio, JVL. Jim Swift, and of course, I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by the folks at ZipRecruiter. Okay, so I have to tell you an obnoxious green room story. It's weird because I was thinking this morning as I woke up, a little bit hungover because I spent some quality time in the Atlanta airport last night, that if I had to write a book about how the left lost its mind, the first scene would probably be the primary night where AOC wins, beats Joe Crowley in that primary, as just sort of the moment when the Democrats were about to blow the election. And sure enough, as I walk in to the makeup area this morning, TV, there's Joe Crowley. And I said to him, I was just thinking about you, man. and I told him my idea. I said, this is what I was thinking. And he was into it. He you know, and we had a really interesting conversation about that and about the way that AOC has become this instant mega super celebrity, but apparently not really like into the business of constituent service back home. What a surprise.
Yeah. When I was on the Hill, this was pre-Trump, we used to make jokes because he was the original Biff Tannen. And then Trump literally became the Biff Tannen.
Oh,
from Back to the Future. But it used to be Joe Crowley.
Really?
So, yeah.
He was Biff Tannen.
Yeah, because he really looked like him, too.
Okay, well, yeah. Seemed like a nice guy. But, I mean,
he's a very nice guy.
We were just talking about, you know, what's going on in the Democratic Party and the even though there's kind of this centrist surge at the moment, you know, you think of all the centrist candidates and how well they're doing, but you still have that all the attention being focused on Elizabeth Warren and Sanders and the fact is, you know, those guys, they will never admit it, but they're pretty mean.
Yeah. I mean, it pays to be mean. I mean, you see, I mean, it's the feature, not the bug of Trumpism. I mean, they've seen what it is and said, well, why don't we do that too?
So I want to ask you about this, JVL. So I actually made a list of all of the centrist candidates that seem to be doing well, not some of them not so well. Steve Bullock dropping out today. Let's start at the
very
opposite
tough.
End.
Pour one out.
Yeah.
Very tough. Bad for Democrats who wanted to have a shot at the Montana Senate seat.
Yeah.
He is not going to run for Senate.
But he actually was a candidate who had something to say. And the fact that he never got onto a debate stage, never was able to break through. This is a governor of a state that Donald Trump won and was a plausible. I mean, that was not a flaky candidacy.
Right. That's right. But on the other hand, Joe Biden, again, like I am Mr. Radio Free Biden, yeah, or the Baghdad Biden or whatever you want, yeah, to say. Biden getting into the race as the vice president for the most recent Democratic two-term president who was immensely popular, sucked up all of the oxygen. And really, if you weren't already in the top tier, I think there was really no plausible path towards getting there, unless you were a, you know, political freak show like Pete Buttigieg, who was just born to be president.
I mean, so here's my short list. Biden, Buttigieg, Bullock, Booker, Patrick, Klobuchar, and obviously Michael Bloomberg. None of them have really much of a real shot, unless, of course, you know, Biden falls apart. Buttigieg is like freaky talented at politics.
Yeah, no,
this guy is... Don't you, are we just overestimating it?
No, he was created in a McKinsey, you know, lab. I mean, central casting for robot perfection.
If he had grown up in Wisconsin, we would all be penciling him in as the nominee for 2020. Don't you think? I mean, because he would have run for Senate in Wisconsin.
It would have been plausible.
Yeah.
So, I mean, here's the theory of the cases, obviously, is that Buttigieg and Booker and Patrick and Klobuchar are kind of waiting for the implosion of Joe Biden, which is constantly being flagged, but it never happens.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. I mean, I've been saying this for months. Well, so here's the thing. I was actually talking about this with Bill this morning on the drive-in. So Biden is in as dominant a position as he has been in yet in the race. He is in his two very difficult early states, Iowa and New Hampshire. He is right in a muddle at the top. He could finish fourth in both of them, but, you know, he's still going to get 15 or 20% in both. He'll be right again. It'll be a mixed race. And he is leading nationally in the polls against all of his rivals. He's leading then in South Carolina and Nevada. And he is the guy with the ironclad, gold-plated lead over Trump, right? As strong as a position as he's been in yet, things have not gone well for him.
No.
And so this is not the result of, like, he's just had a great couple of weeks. He's been, the impeachment thing has been very, very hard for him. He's been taking, my God, Donald Trump is running ads against him. Donald Trump is already up on the air against him.
Millions of dollars.
Donald Trump chose to get impeached in an attempt to sully Biden. And so even in the midst of tremendous adversity, even with his eye exploding on national television, even with all the missteps and the gaffes and the munching his wife's fingers and saying things are kind of weird and out in left field.
What was that about? Biting his wife's finger?
Who could say? That's just a crazy Uncle Joe being crazy Uncle Joe. But even with all that, his support is durable. And this is what I just don't understand in all the horse race analysis where everybody's just sort of assuming past Biden. I just don't get it because he looks incredibly formidable to me. What do you guys think?
Well, past Biden, lest we forget, was just the same Joe Biden as we have now. I mean, minus a little bit of the senility. You know, you can't walk into a 7-Eleven without a slight Indian accent. That clip from the 80s that made Andrew Kaczynski, now of CNN, famous, where Biden was on the presidential campaign trail talking falsely about how he finished first in his law school class and, you know, asking the IQ of some random voter. I mean, demeaning a voter and suggesting my IQ is higher than yours. I mean, this is all Joe Biden. It's just he's become more likable as he's gotten older and maybe a little bit more forgetful. You know, there hasn't been a huge change in the kind of prickishness of Joe Biden, but it's a lovable, affable prickishness.
And I do get the sense the voters are more locked in than we give them credit for being. I think the race is what the race is. And I don't know. The person who's in real trouble is Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a definite inflection point in this campaign. You can almost put your finger on the week when it all changed. She was rising. She was dominant. People were assuming that it was hers to lose. Then she came up with her plan, how to pay for.
The same week as the poll.
I was going to say. And it was like 1-2 punch. She comes out with this. People go, ooh, the numbers really don't add up or they're kind of scary. And then the poll, the New York Times Siena poll. And that was this collective gasp on Democrats going, oh, man, we could really blow this.
Yeah. And then when she walked away from her own Medicare for All plan by then introducing the transition plan. And again, the killer here is she did that dishonestly. So the transition plan is essentially a surrender on Medicare for All, but she won't say it out loud in the same way that with the Medicare for All plan, she wouldn't say out loud all the parts about the cost.
And it's all self-inflicted, too. She was beating back Trump. I mean, she was one of the first candidates, as you opined on a previous podcast, who was able to defeat a Trumpian silver bullet about Pocahontas. It didn't work. And then Elizabeth Warren has a plan, and that was her downfall because she was representing herself as the wonk and then tripped up over her, you know.
Well, she just had too many plans. At a certain point, she was the person that came into the room and people would discuss, you know, their concerns, and she, well, I have a plan for that. She's like the most obnoxious person you've ever met at a party, right? Who's got an answer for absolutely everything. Okay, so like she's out today saying that she wants to be the last president elected by the Electoral College, that by her second term she wants to be elected by the popular vote. What's going on? That's not going to happen.
So it's not going to happen.
No, it's not going to.
It shouldn't happen. The Electoral College is, despite all of its faults, incredibly important and a good thing. And we could talk about that if you want to. But she's entered the Beto death spiral where she's just casting about for anything for the progressive Twitter to latch on to make them love her again. And I just think it's bad, especially when, again, Bernie is sitting right there. The other problem she has is she's got an equivalent product sitting on the shelf who has been incredibly durable himself. Bernie's support is not modulated hardly at all. And if you were a progressive Warren supporter who was there for the progressive policies, not for the virtue signaling or the bandwagon effect or anything else, but was there for the policies, why wouldn't you get on board with Bernie at this point?
Okay, just remind us, Jim, what does it take to abolish the Electoral College?
I mean, amending the Constitution.
Okay, amending the Constitution, which requires, help me, like 2/3 of the vote of the Senate.
Yeah, or like 3/5 states, right?
Like pretty much both, right? I mean, you'd have to have like 3/4 of the states, many of them giving up their power and their rights. This is just not going to happen. So, and I'm guessing that outside the you know, the juicier precincts of Twitter, people do realize that she's making another promise she can't keep, that she's just throwing this out. And I have you watched any of these Buttigieg ads, by the way? He and Biden are both really going after making promises that are unrealistic, promises that are going to alienate the electorate and that are going to be unkept. And I think that's really effective. When, like, Buttigieg goes out on this, you know, free college and goes, hey, you know, I have a plan for making college more affordable, but other people say you have to be bolder, and it's not bold enough if you're not paying free tuition for the children of millionaires and billionaires. And I just don't think we need to go. I mean, I'm thinking, yeah, I bet that plays in the town hall meetings in Iowa.
And in a general election, too.
And the polling reflects that. I mean, people forget that Twitter, I mean, you point this out in your newsletter all the time, Jonathan. Twitter is not real life, whether it's conservative Twitter, Never Trump Twitter, MAGA Twitter, Democratic Twitter. It's just not real life.
You saw that story over the weekend that one of the problems with the implosion of the Kamala Harris campaign was that her staffers did take Twitter seriously. They thought, yeah, we have like, well, maybe they should have listened to the podcast.
It's crazy. Not to toot our own horns, yeah, but the Kamala Harris problem was exactly what all of us here at The Bulwark have been saying from the beginning. She didn't have any reason for running for president, and voters smell that. They always smell it.
You know, since you're like half spiking the football here,
do
you remember the morning after? Because I remember the morning after that first, that debate in which she went after Joe Biden. And everybody in the world was like, this is Kamala's moment. This is her breakthrough. It's great. And I think you and I were both the guys out there going, actually, Joe Biden wasn't that bad. And this was not a breakthrough moment. And this is not going to play well. I mean, I remember sitting, you know, composing my newsletter thinking, who actually thinks that bringing back mandatory forced busing is the winning issue in 2020? I mean, really.
Again, it's really important to watch these debates without having Twitter on. And I say this all the time, if you have Twitter on while you're watching a debate and you're paying attention to Twitter, you're not actually thinking for yourself. You're being amalgamated into the hive mind, and that's never good.
All right, let's talk about impeachment a little bit, but I want to start off with this. I don't think we need to play the audio, Jim, of John Kennedy on Meet the Press, because everybody's heard it, or anybody that wants to hear it has heard it.
It's the same as his last audio where he was repeating Putin's talking points.
Okay, so John Kennedy is a guy with a degree from Oxford, right?
Yes.
He's got academic credentials. Up until now, he's never been considered an idiot. And he looked two things yesterday. He looked addled, as well as a willing, basically Russian asset spouting Putin-esque propaganda. I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second, but first, here's a word from our sponsor.
Hiring is challenging, and it used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter. In fact, go to ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. And they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you cannot miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, listeners here can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/begin. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEGIN. ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Okay, we're back. JVL, Jim Swift, Charlie Sykes here in our Bulwark studio. See, I think A.B. Stoddard, in her fantastic piece, which everybody should read in the Bulwark about the impeachment, you know, she points out Kennedy has now gone full Devin Nunes.
Yeah.
Okay, it's one thing.
Eventually they all do.
Well, okay, but why? It's one thing to support the president. I like the conservative judges. I like the whatever it is, the other things that President Trump is doing. But why do you have to go full Devin Nunes?
I don't think it's a binary choice.
No.
But you look at the people like David Jolly, people, you know, we like and put on our podcast and everything. A lot of these folks in elected office just look at the writing on the wall and they can just say, I'm going to retire. And you see that there are a lot of people retiring.
Right.
Or they just say, well, if I'm going to stick around and, you know, get my high three and get a good pension in out of all of this and maybe get an appointment to something. I just kind of got to toe the line. And there are very few people far in between.
But you can toe the line without spouting just complete hoaxes that were cooked up by Russian military intelligence. I'm sorry.
Well, maybe that used to be the case. Maybe you have to now.
I don't think you can, actually.
Anymore?
So that position was always predicated upon being able to say, look, at the end of the day, the good outweighs the bad. Well, we're almost at the end of the day. We're 3 years into a four-year term, and you can't really say that anymore. The bad has become so pervasive and so bad, and we are at the sort of constitutional crisis that everybody said was the worst-case scenario. Not the worst case, but a very high variant scenario for Trump, where you have him attempting to coerce a foreign power into interfering in an American election on his behalf by withholding military aid. And that is not just garden variety corruption. It is not going to the president of Ukraine and say, hey, you're going to sign off on this hotel deal that I want to do in Kiev.
Yeah.
Because if that was happening, that's just corruption. Like, right. We always have corruption. When somebody is trying to interfere in a future election, that's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, really bad. And so at some point, you have to either go full Devin Nunes and insist that none of it is bad, or you have to grapple with the fact that it's really bad. And when you start doing that, the whole ball of string starts unraveling.
How much of this is about primary challenges? I mean, you look at this and
you would think it would be, but he's got Kennedy doesn't have a challenge.
Or
in danger.
Yeah, or maybe this is to forego it because if you are insufficiently constantly defending Trump, and hour after or a day after Kennedy made that remark on Meet the Press, he got a presidential accolade.
Well, you do wonder what it is he's angling for, and I don't know that with him, maybe he wants an ambassadorship or something. I just don't know. But I mean, look, there's been a lot of things that have happened. It's hard to keep up with the news cycle. I think this, by the way, is a real problem with impeachment, is that people haven't had a chance to absorb the information we've gotten. I mean, just since the end of the Intelligence Committee, A.B. Stoddard just sort of ran down some of the stories. And even I'm going, oh, yeah, that's true. That would happen over the holiday. I kind of missed that. New York Times reporting that American intelligence officials informed senators and their aides in recent weeks that Russia had engaged in a years-long campaign to essentially frame Ukraine as responsible for Moscow's own hacking of the 2016 election. That's the fictional narrative that Fiona Hill was talking about. And then Kennedy goes out and shares it on Meet the Press. And now we're finding out that Lev Parnas, who's one of Rudy's cronies, told CNN that Devin Nunes actually met with the disgraced, fired, corrupt prosecutor from Ukraine. The Post apparently is privy to a series of internal administration emails depicting a scramble to retroactively explain Trump's Ukraine action. I mean, it keeps going and going and going. So if you were advising the Democrats going into this week, where they're going to the judiciary hearing, is there any way to broaden the appeal of this or break the absolute solid wall of Republican support? Because I'm having a hard time coming up with what they could do that they have not already done or that would make a difference.
Well, I think there might be. And that is to focus on the obstruction of justice charge. So you've got a guy like Will Hurd, who during his final statement during the hearings said, look, this is all pretty bad, and it seems like it's against the natural interest, but you got to have ironclad proof before you go impeaching and removing a president. And there's just a lot of things we don't know. And if one of the articles of impeachment is obstruction of justice, because the White House has refused to make the people who would have the ironclad proof available, I would think that if your stated position is Will Hurd, as Will Hurd has produced his, and you are saying that in good faith and not merely as an assertion of will to power, then it is very hard not to vote for at least the obstruction of justice article.
Yeah, that's a big if, though. So, I mean, A.B. Stoddard made that point that if they do put in the obstruction of justice article, that 14 Senate Republicans would be in the awkward position of having voted in support of the same charge for Clinton. Graham, Wicker, Burr, Portman, John Thune, Jerry Moran and Roy Blunt as House members voted to impeach Clinton. Enzi McConnell, Roberts, Chuck Grassley, Jim Inhofe, Richard Shelby, and Mike Crapo. Is it Crapo?
Crapo.
Crapo as senators voting to convict him. Same thing.
I'm sure Lindsey Graham will give this a full and honest hearing, right?
Yeah. So, hey, so our friend Molly Jong Fast had a big scoop. She got Lisa Page to give her first interview, the FBI agent, coming out talking about, you know, what it's like to be attacked by the president, and saying that the key moment of what, Jim, we will have to drop in this audio. She said the key moment was when the president mimicked an orgasm while talking about her.
Yeah.
That was the breaking. Okay, we'll drop that in.
That was 19 minutes after the oath of office. Months earlier, Peter Strzok. Remember, he and his lover, Lisa Page. What a group. She's going to win. 10 million to 1, she's going to win. I'm telling you, Peter. I'm telling you, Peter, she's going to win. Peter, oh, I love you so much. I love you, Peter. I love you too, Lisa. Lisa, I love you. Lisa. Lisa. Oh, God, I love you, Lisa. And if she doesn't win, Lisa, we've got an insurance policy, Lisa. We'll get that son of a bitch out. We got an insurance policy. And we're living through the insurance policy. That's what it is. The phony Russia hoax.
So that, according to Lisa Page, was the breaking point, and she's not going to be silent anymore.
That apparently was enough for her. You know, whether or not that's true is in her own mind, but there was a certain time period as she left the FBI in which I believe there was some, you know, there's contractual thing about talking about what you did when you were there, and there was an investigation that was underway, and it was a very interesting interview that Molly gave over at the Daily Beast, which is causing a lot of consternation on the right. And Gerald Beer, an old friend of ours, I thought had an interesting response to Gabriel Mallor, who's a lawyer and a writer on the right, who observed that there were some Trump supporters on Twitter even doubting the whole pantomiming of the orgasm that Trump did. And of course, he provided the audio.
They were doubting that it was an orgasm.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, okay.
And so Jerry says, Trump supporters find themselves in the awkward position of emphasizing the sordid, illicit extramarital affair to hit her credibility, while at the same time insisting Trump wasn't implying what he was clearly implying, which the audience seems to get quite clearly. And the very first response from a Trump supporter is, no, you know, I don't find my position awkward at all.
No, no.
That's all you need to know.
Well, they're in this far. Actually, it's a powerful interview. It's a great get for Molly. On the other hand, any time that we spend talking about Lisa Page, we're off on following the squirrel. I mean, we're back where Trump wants us to be talking about, which is talk about the tainted beginning of the investigation. And you know that we're going to be consumed for 48 hours by a news cycle when this
IG report comes out.
Yeah, right. Which who knows where that's going to be. Okay. So,
total exoneration.
Oh, so the president actually tweeted out that there was an interview by the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, where Zelensky essentially says he doesn't trust anybody anymore, and clearly pushing back on Trump, saying if you're our friend, you shouldn't be threatening us. Trump tweets out that big news, the president just said that Trump did nothing wrong, and everybody's looking at it going, no, he didn't say that at all. This is the challenge, by the way.
Yeah, just everyone's a nihilist, including the president
exactly.
of Ukraine.
Well, no, but I mean, the challenge is this blizzard of bullshit that we just have to navigate our way through. And I think that this is what's sort of bending people.
Well, this is the authoritarian impulse. It is, I feel like I say this twice a week. Normal politics involves people lying by shading or bending the truth or obscuring from view something they did or did not do. Authoritarian politics consists of saying that 2 + 2 = 5. And that is what Trump has introduced into the mainstream of American politics. He acts like a dictator in terms of formulating his own truths, which he will say, which is totally untethered to anything else. And it's, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to.
It's exhausting.
Sound too much of an. Well, it's dangerous.
Well,
it's
no,
really dangerous.
It's dangerous, and it's exhausting, which makes it dangerous. Because, in fact, I was just talking to Sarah Longwell before we started the podcast, and we were both saying how exhausting all of this is. That if we are exhausted talking about it, imagine what the average voter, and I think this is the one of the overriding political realities. Just can't take it anymore and is kind of tuned out on it, which is part of the goal of exhausting your critical sensibilities. That if there is no truth, if you can't ascertain what the truth is, if everything you hear is a lie, then why pay attention?
Well, you know, we're going to have to tune in to the new Falkirk Center's report,
my God.
Charlie Kirk and Jerry Falwell Jr., because I'm old enough and I'm the youngest guy here to remember how hard the right fought against moral relativism. It was the worst thing in the world. The liberals, they have no conscience. They have no morality. They believe in no universal truths. And now that's kind of the marching orders of the right.
Okay, so for people who hadn't heard about this, this is Liberty University has created a new center to defend Jesus and the Constitution. Have I got this right?
Yes.
Okay. And they couldn't come up with a name, so they just sort of mashed together the names of the two intellectual giants who are running this. This is not a parody. I am not kidding about this. It's Jerry Falwell and Charlie Kirk, so they call it the Falkirk Center.
Yes.
You know what the most amazing part about that is? How is Dinesh D'Souza not part of this? I mean, really.
I want to know why it's not the Kirkwell Center, because I got to say, I think that Charlie Kirk is the senior partner in this little affair.
I think so, too. They did an interview.
He certainly has the more intellectual horsepower.
How do these people find each other? You know, it's like there's a magnet in the universe of, like, the worst people.
The bad guys always find each other.
Yeah, the old Bill Kristol thing. We had that on the last Megacast. Yep. But their rollout was an exclusive in the Washington Examiner and an interview horribly poorly edited on One America News. That was just amazing because they're also, you know, the Battle of Falkirk was the other thing. But my favorite part from the Examiner fawning press release, which essentially was what Paul Bedard did in previewing it. Charlie Kirk gets this question a lot when he's talking out, you know, with the kids who are doing what he didn't, which is to go to college. And they want to know whether or not Jesus was actually a socialist.
That's right.
They're going to get to the bottom of it.
Because the left is waging a war upon on Christianity, right?
And Chick-fil-A is too.
But and Charlie Kirk's very upset about Chick-fil-A. Yes. But if Christianity really is under siege and faces an existential threat, it's not from the left right now. It's what it's doing to itself.
Yeah.
If Christianity is in trouble and Charlie Kirk is there to save it, it's in more trouble than we thought.
Yeah, that's we are in the end times. If that's what it is.
8 years from now, he'll have a mega church in West Palm Beach, and and we're going to see it on Sunday services on the Trump Network.
Okay.
That's the way this ends.
Okay, so there's an economist named Tyler Cowen, is that right?
Yes, George Mason.
Okay, so he has a thing on, I'm going to make this relevant here, because JVL, I want to get your take on this.
The kids,
okay. So he wrote an article about things he's reading. And he's reading the speeches of Greta Thunberg. He says, call me crazy, but I think of Greta Thunberg and Donald Trump as the two great orators of our generation, regardless of what you think of their content. I've read that over several times. The two, like, I mean, this is like the mega troll of all time, right? Because Donald Trump is one of the great orators of our time. Let's leave that aside. The Greta Thunberg thing, I admit, I have stayed away from commenting on her at all because I figure, why bring it down on your head? But once again, this is part of this thing, and we talked about this, I think, probably back at the old Weekly Standard podcast. This worship of the young idealistic child.
Whether it's gun control or...
Gun control, and, you know, the right has done it, the left has done it, and Greta has become, quote-unquote, self-aware, by which I mean she's like... become Greta Thunberg as the entity, because now she's railing not just at climate change, but at patriarchy and racism and colonialism, all of which must be abolished, I guess. So
good luck with that.
Well, it's like you can tell that she's free. I am Greta Thunberg. I must speak in oracular terms, and I must keep escalating the radical nature of my insight into the universe. And it's like, why do we do this? And it's in part because then so the guys like me won't say like maybe the kids
should shut up.
Mm-hmm.
I can say I'll say it because I am the kid here. I like Tyler Cowen. I've read a number of his books. An Economist Gets Lunch is great. He's got a lot of interesting insights. But like all economists, they have peculiar worldviews and life views that, let's just say, your man on the street isn't going to share. And I think that what maybe Cowen sees is that Trump, like Thunberg, have been able to harness and ride the zeitgeist of popular culture and media coverage like rodeo riders. And therefore, they must be the best orators because the data's there, perhaps. That without knowing exactly Cowen's argument. But he's an interesting outside-the-box thinker. I think he missed the mark here.
Yeah, a little bit missed the mark here. Okay, speaking of which, you know what? I remember what I wanted to lead off with you guys. The most obvious story over the weekend. It's almost too easy. So let's not try to make it a total dunk.
Ohio State, Michigan.
Yeah. Who's a Michigan fan here?
Nobody.
Okay, good. Okay, so.
I'm a big Notre Dame fan.
Really? Okay. YouGov Economist poll finds that a majority of Republicans think that Donald Trump is a better president than Abraham Lincoln. 53-47. They pick Donald Trump over Abraham Lincoln. Okay. Yeah, we're speechless.
I don't have anything to say about that. I mean,
not a cult.
I am not surprised, actually.
I saw people trying to spin the results as, well, you know, some people, you know, maybe just wanted to push back and they thought that this was a trick of a trap question.
Yeah.
And they wanted to show that they supported Trump. That may be true, but it might be true from the opposite. Yeah, there might be people who think Donald Trump is a greater president than a Republican president than Lincoln, but didn't want to fall in the trap the other thing. But you can't get inside these people's heads. You just can't. But the result is depressing.
Yeah, I mean, Jonah made the suggestion that this maybe was just a big F you to the pollsters and to the establishment. But in fairness, when they asked people who's a better president, Ronald Reagan or Donald Trump, it was a pretty solid vote for the Gipper, 59-41. So that's good, I guess.
So let's pretend that. So what was the percentage on the Trump-Lincoln?
53-47.
Okay. So let's pretend that 80% of the people saying Trump were saying it as an F you to the pollsters.
Okay.
Okay, let's grant you. Mm-hmm. So that leaves still 10% of the Republican Party who thinks that Trump is better. And I suspect that for them it is a sincere belief having to do with views on race.
In Civil War.
Because to the type of people who think that Confederate statues are great and that the people who marched in Charlottesville are very fine people, I think they have a very dim view of Lincoln, frankly.
Right.
The people in America who have a dim view of Lincoln are 100% Trump supporters. Now, the converse is not true, but it is true that everybody in America who is a big-time white supremacist and racist and doesn't like Lincoln for the War of Northern Aggression is today a Trump supporter.
And
this is just a fact.
And I'll take that a step further. They're itching for Civil War. They're the type of people who buy the Kurt Schlichter novels and read those sorts of things, and they're just ready for another one, and Donald Trump is going to be their leader.
If you are a regular reader of V-Dare.
Yes, which I'm not. Yeah.
You 100% on the merits think that Trump is better than Lincoln. Because what did Lincoln
on
do?
On the merits.
Because what did Lincoln do?
Yeah.
Freed slaves.
Well, right?
Waged war against patriotic Americans who didn't want to be cucks.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Yeah. Actually, I'm glad, interesting you say that because I was going to make some, snide comments about historical ignorance. Is your point is, no, it's not historical ignorance. It's actually a complete understanding of the historical roles that they're playing.
Yeah.
And an opinion about that.
Yeah. And again, I'm willing to grant that that's not 53%, but that even if you take off of the table a huge chunk of those people who are not playing the game straight up.
The number's too high.
It's too high to not include a non-trivial number of people who are there for the racism.
This is an indication, though, of also what has happened to the Republican Party and the conservative movement. I mean, it's one thing to say it's a binary choice between Trump and Elizabeth Warren, Trump and the, social justice warriors. But clearly, when you're given a choice, Lincoln or Trump, this is the safest non-Trumpian thing you could do, right? You would think.
Yes.
But no. Did you see any of the other numbers? Do they rank him against George Washington? I didn't even look at that.
So that interests me, actually, is what they would do with Washington or Roosevelt.
Because you think that Abraham Lincoln is perhaps unusually toxic to that alt-right group?
Yes, actually. Yeah, I would bet that Reagan
nobody else
would
has made
pull
that
worse than either Roosevelt. Let me see. Who else would be sort of an obvious top shelf?
Well, Roosevelt locked up the bad American. So, you know, I mean, clearly.
He was a fighter.
Yeah. I mean, according to that you know, horrible mindset, I don't believe that.
Washington.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So we have a new trade war thing today. This is your
thing. Oh, yeah. With Argentina and about steel and everything.
That has to do with currency, right?
Yes.
Currency devaluation.
Yeah.
And the president. So the president of the United States has the unilateral power to impose tariffs for national security when currencies of other countries fluctuate.
Yeah, which is every day. You know, I mean,
right.
Currencies always fluctuate, and most governments manipulate their currency. I mean, Donald Trump is pressuring Jerome Powell at the Fed to, you know, keep things low, to keep the economy going. You know, Powell and the Fed doesn't, FOMC don't have, the Federal Open Markets Committee don't have to listen to him. But the U.S. is manipulating its currency. We all do. And South America, I mean, there aren't many powerhouse South American economies. It's you know, you have your ups and downs, but they're always manipulating their currency because that's one of the few levers of power that they have to not turn into Zimbabwe.
So I have a question for you guys. Are we arriving at the point in public life where you can no longer legislate in good faith? So, for instance, the trade war provision is, right, you know, you're
Section
allowed to unilaterally do it if it's in the case of national security,
right?
And nobody pays attention to that anymore,
right?
It's like having an abortion law that provides an exception for the health of the mother, right? The health is always the out that can mean whatever you want it to be. Are we reaching a point where you just can't write laws with common sense provisions which allow for some judgment by the executive, because the executive, you can just assume that the executives will not operate in good faith? Is that where we're headed?
And for far too long, we've deferred to the executive. You know, Congress always wanted to be seen as doing something, but not making the hard decisions.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why they delegate to the various administrative agencies. And of course, liberals like that because it was broader executive power and the ability to regulate. And Republicans did that too with the EPA. I mean, even the formation of the EPA was pretty much that. And now Republicans, I mean, that's one of the few bright spots that conservatives who aren't MAGA heads will point to. Well, look at them rolling back, you know, these bad regulations. Well, why don't we just roll back the ability to make these bad regulations? Well, you know, that could limit Trump's power.
Well, this may be a good thing, though. This may be the wake up to realize that we've assumed an honor system, that we then Congress would give the power to the president, assuming he would act in good faith. And maybe the reality of checks and balances ought to be that let's not assume that they're going to act in good faith. You know, that every time you pass a bill, Democrats ought to, you know, ask themselves, what would a Donald Trump do with this legislation? And Republicans ought to ask themselves, what would a Bernie Sanders do with this legislation? I think that would be, you know, by the way, speaking of other issues that nobody actually cares about, but to our folks who believe that Donald Trump is bringing back, you know, making America great again, actually, you see this thing from Bloomberg over the weekend that the Trump making agricultural socialism great again?
Yeah, we're double the auto bailout.
The farm rescue is now more than twice as expensive as the 2009 auto industry bailout, which ultimately cost taxpayers $12 billion. Almost 40% of projected farm profits this year will come from trade aid, disaster assistance, federal subsidies, and insurance payments.
I forget, what did Republicans say about the auto bailout?
Socialism.
Did they like it?
I think they were skeptical.
Huh.
They were just a little bit
so weird.
Yeah. And that was a loan that had to be repaid, and you know it wasn't completely repaid, but for the most part it was. A set of loans.
Yeah, I guess so. So what else do you guys want to talk about? By the way, I really like your JVL, your thing about the Elizabeth Warren being in the Beto death spiral.
Yeah. Do you think
there's something that's a real thing?
Honestly, after the last debate, I wasn't sure if she was in a death spiral or it was just a market correction. I now think it's a death spiral, actually. I don't think she has any answers. you know, for her foundational problems. And I don't even know if she understands what her foundational problems are.
There's that old joke about what the kamikaze instructor said to his students, which was, watch closely, I'm only going to do this once. The way Beto went out changed the nature of the way Democrats talk about guns, because he said things that Democrats never really ever wanted to say out in the open, but Republicans long believed that they believed. And I think that'll be an interesting question for Warren and some of the other folks as they try and make these ways to get out of a death spiral.
She hasn't figured out how to do that.
But it could change the nature of the debate fundamentally for those who remain.
But in what way?
Well, like Beto did it about gun manufacturers.
Yeah.
And, you know,
but he got no traction.
Right. But now you're alienating the kind of centrist people.
Yeah. You think he moved the Overton window on what you have to say out loud in order to prove your fealty to the issue.
Right. There might have been people right. willing to vote for Biden until he changed his views on the Hyde Amendment.
Right.
Then there might have been some people who said, oh, you know, Biden's not really great on guns, but at least he doesn't want to sue the gun manufacturers for liability. That's a little too far. Now he's there. You know, if Warren could do that in a way, I mean, that will fundamentally, her lasting contribution will not be Medicare for all or her flip-flop on pens. It could just be what does she want to do as she goes out the door that will just change the nature of those who are still left in the fray.
Yeah. She's also about to get sucked into a trench warfare against Pete Buttigieg, which is, again, good for Biden, bad for her. You know, because she's... For Warren to be the nominee, she has to win both Iowa and New Hampshire. There is no plausible path for her.
A split decision is very good for Biden.
Yes. Yeah. And the truth is, even if she wins both, that is necessary but not sufficient for her to capture the nomination. So she has to go after Buttigieg. She can't sit back and keep doing her thing. And I just think that's very dangerous territory for a canny political talent like Buttigieg is.
Well, you know, it's funny. We were talking about all the moderates in the field who are actually now playing off of her, these kinds of extremism. You know, every time a Beto says, let's take away people's guns, you have other Democrats who go, whoa, wait. Well, that's not where we're coming from. Every time she says, you know, I have a Medicare for all plan, you have people like Pete Buttigieg going, wait, no, how about Medicare for people who like it? This list, I left some folks out. So you had Biden, Buttigieg, until yesterday, Bullock. Booker, I think, could be there.
Yep.
Patrick, who's apparently going absolutely nowhere. Klobuchar, who's kind of waiting in the wings and plausible. Bloomberg, and I forgot about Bennett.
That's right.
Bennett has been sitting there essentially saying, look, we can't win by running these things. So you have a lot of voices. I know on social media, it's all you never Trumpers, you Republicans want a Republican light. The strongest centrist Democratic voices, amazingly, are centrist Democrats.
And this, again, it's a virtuous cycle for the Democrats, because if you can win the nomination in the Democratic primary by running to the center, your position for the general election against Trump is so strong. You know, I mean, you just start out with enormous built-in advantages against a deeply unpopular president. And if your nominee is an incredibly popular and likable figure like Joe Biden, for whom all of his problems are baked in, and for who, honestly, is sort of uniquely positioned to run well against Trump, because all the things that are bad and worrisome about Biden are 50 times worse with Trump, right? All of his vulnerabilities and weaknesses are Trump's vulnerability and weaknesses, but at a smaller scale. So
And if you're worried about him losing, someone asked me this over Thanksgiving about Biden and his slips. And I said, if you're worried about landing the ship, Joe Biden is someone who comes from decades of public service, who has hundreds of alumni who would populate a Biden administration, and I've seen senators actually be senile. Pete Domenici is an example. May he rest in peace. Robert Byrd is another example. The staff will land the ship. And if you're worried, if the question is Joe Biden in his slip ups and his issues, or Trump and his issues, who do you think is going to attract better people to land the ship? And I think the answer is obvious.
Yeah.
Question is, you know, it's not a binary choice because we're not there yet. Biden has to win the nomination, and that's going to be tough for him. But to your point, it would be far less bad to have that infrastructure there than, you know, a place where people last maybe two and a half months. You know,
okay. All right. So we're out of time here. So movie recommendations.
I say Men in the High Castle. It's not a movie. Men in the High Castle, season 4. It's the best season.
If it's, I binged it. If it's still out by you, Midway. I really like Midway.
I had a choice to make the other night. It was either Knives Out or Midway.
Did you like Knives
Out? I loved Knives Out.
Really? Okay. Yes. I want to see it. It looks great.
I strongly recommend it. And I went in with a little bit of skepticism, but it's different.
It is Rian Johnson.
Yeah, what?
It is Rian Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're making your face, yeah.
Well, he's the guy who like wrecked the Star Wars franchise, but that's okay.
I don't have that prejudice.
I should thank him.
Okay, so funny, you know.
Mandalorian. It's gone on too long.
Are you watching The Mandalorian?
No. Star Wars should have died a decade ago. A movie a year is not sustainable. You can't make a good movie every year.
Okay. So Man in the High Castle, interesting you should say this, because on my flight here last night when I got my bad experience in Atlanta, I downloaded a few episodes of 4, and I started watching and thinking, ooh, I need to go back and watch episode 3 because it's so complicated. But I did. I managed to move. And you're right. Season number 4 is very, very good. I agree with you. Also, I watched this new movie called The Report, which is out for you political Capitol Hill
on Amazon. Is it good? Right?
Amazon. I was surprised, and I think raised a lot of questions that made me want to go back and read more about, you know, what's spin and what's factual about it. But yeah, Man in the High Castle, but definitely Knives Out.
And have either of you watched The Irishman?
No, I was thinking of that. Have you?
I'm going to do it this week, but since it's 3.5 hours long, I'm going to have to watch it over the course of like 5 nights.
Yeah, that was the problem. I had to decide what can I download for a flight. You know, if I was flying from D.C. to L.A., I might download it.
Someone on Twitter told me a factoid about The Irishman is that the one of the actors who plays the priest was actually a priest who recently quit the priesthood, who was a Fox News commentator. So if you look at the priest and you're like, that guy looks familiar.
I know him.
Oh, yeah. I know that him too. I know who that is. So what makes Midway so good? I mean, I've seen a million of these movies.
It's not a war movie.
Okay.
It's a disaster movie with a war movie coat of paint on it.
Ooh.
And it's a really great disaster movie.
Okay.
And it's just fun. It moves from point to point. Imagine this. It's, you know, those jukebox musicals where they take, you know, it's like, we're going to do a movie about Elton John. It'll just have all the best parts of Elton John.
Right.
All the Elton John songs you love are in it.
Yeah.
This is a movie about the Pacific campaign, but with all the battles in the Pacific campaign that you love.
Oh, really?
Pearl Harbor, okay. The Doolittle Raid, the Marshall Islands, Midway. And those are the set pieces.
I have to see that at a theater, too.
Yeah.
This is when you don't wait till it comes out.
No, don't do it on your phone.
No, you want to see the big screen.
Is the USS Indianapolis in it? That's like my favorite.
It is not.
That's my favorite Pacific thing that, yeah.
Well, that's so sad, though. That's just depressing.
No, it's...
Why do you leave us on that sad
note? It ended the war. The USS Indianapolis saved lives.
Eyes, dark eyes.
Yeah, really?
Doll's eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they brought the nuclear material over in the secret thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was ultimate sacrifice to help
Speaking
end the war.
Speaking of jukebox movies, have you seen Yesterday? You ever heard about what this is?
Yes.
Well, why are you?
Is this the Bruce Springsteen
one? The Beatles one.
The
Beatles one. You know, the basically, you know, failing musician. Something happens. Just
they're
just
literally the same. The same movie.
Oh, are they?
One with Bruce Springsteen and one with the Beatles.
Okay, so yeah, the whole world forgets the Beatles. They made two movies like that.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. No. So
Hollywood would never do that to us.
they would never do that. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And we will be back. We will do this tomorrow. Today's episode was brought to you by our friends at ZipRecruiter.